Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, who explains why she believes that in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks in Paris, reliance on military strategies alone cannot defeat ISIS. Nate Cardozo of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who criticizes officials calling for expanded surveillance after the Paris attacks, as cynical politics at their absolute worst. And excerpts of speeches by Desmond Batts and Bernardo McLaughlin addressing climate change issues at the recent 100% Renewable Energy for 100% of the People rally in Hartford, Connecticut. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A few days after the terror attacks in Paris, suicide bombers in northeast Nigeria detonated two explosions that killed 49 people and injured over 100 civilians. The attacks were blamed on Boko Haram, the long-running Islamist insurgency responsible for killing over 17,000 people and forcing over 2.5 million people to flee their homes in Africa's Lake Chad region. The attacks came after the Nigerian army had pressed an offensive into Boko Haram-held territory. Boko Haram has been named by the Institute of Economics and Peace as the most violent terrorist group in the world, narrowly surpassing ISIL after the carnage it inflicted in Syria and Iraq during 2014. Boko Haram won international condemnation when it kidnapped 276 schoolgirls from the village of Chibok. 50 girls later escaped their captors, but the fate of the remaining students remains a mystery. Many local Muslim imams and Christian priests have stepped forward to feed the hundreds of thousands of people displaced by the terrorist group in Nigeria. Public images of poverty in America are mostly portrayed in urban scenes of black and Hispanic destitution, often linked to drugs and gangs. But the flip side of poverty found in rural America is often associated with small towns inhabited by whites in Appalachia, the Ozarks, and the Dakotas. According to the news magazine In These Times, since the 1950s, poverty in rural America has increased. This is especially true in the American South, where rural poverty has grown 8% faster than that found in cities. While the white population makes up the majority of urban and rural poor, rates of deprivation run much deeper in minority rural populations. Poverty rates among blacks, Latinos, and Native Americans are much higher than for whites living in rural America. Ozarks native Lisa Pruitt, now a law professor at the University of California at Davis, commented, "When we talk about poverty, we focus on black poverty and we focus on Hispanic poverty. We've collapsed our nation's poverty problem into our nation's racism problem, and it leads us to turn a blind eye to rural poverty." For thousands of years, the Western Shoshone tribal community has gathered at the Tosawihi quarries in Elk County, Nevada, to collect flint stones and to practice spiritual rituals. The word Tosawihi means white knives, an ancient ancestral name that ties the Shoshone to the land and to its cultural identity. For generations, gold deposits were found underneath the flint, and wealthy miners are now eager to extract it, reports the news magazine In These Times. 2 years ago, the Waterton Global Mining Company bought an abandoned gold mine and quickly launched operations with the blessing of the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. However, tribal leader Joe Holly of the Battle Mountain Band of the Western Shoshone says new drilling pads were constructed on pristine land, but the mining company didn't obtain the necessary groundwater permits. A lawyer for the Battle Mountain Band filed an emergency appeal with the Interior Board of Appeals. The tribe is seeking to suspend mining until a plan is approved to safeguard the cultural integrity of the quarries. But the mining company, now named Carlin Resources, challenged the appeal, saying the case was filled with erroneous and sensationalistic assertions. The Bureau of Land Management, which oversees this stretch of federal land, identified numerous cultural artifacts, including ancient stone tools, that were discovered on the site, and instructed miners to stay out of the area where the antiquities were found. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
Thank you.
After the multiple terrorist attacks in Paris on November 13th that killed 130 and wounded 350 more, French President François Hollande declared war on ISIS, the group which claimed responsibility for the massacre of Parisians at a stadium, concert hall, restaurants, and cafes. Before a joint session of Parliament, Hollande said the coordinated terrorist assault was an attack against our country, against its values, against its youth, against its way of life. Amid fear of new attacks, France and Belgium launched dozens of raids on the homes of suspected terrorists and their accomplices. In retaliation for the carnage in Paris, President Hollande ordered the French Air Force to increase airstrikes against ISIS targets in the group's self-declared capital in Raqqa, Syria, bombing command and recruitment centers, as well as an ammunition storage base and training camps. The French president, vowing to destroy ISIS, called on Russia and America to unite our forces in a coalition to defeat the terrorist group, a goal made more difficult by Turkey's recent shooting down of a Russian fighter jet engaged in combat near the Syrian-Turkish border. In a recent article published in The Nation magazine titled, "After the Paris Attacks, A Call for Justice, Not Vengeance," Phyllis Bennis recounts how 14 years of war after the 9/11 attacks against the U.S. have failed to defeat terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Your reporter spoke with Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, about her view that reliance on military strategies alone cannot defeat ISIS, and the domestic backlash against Syrian war refugees.
What I'm really afraid was the response in Paris, Scott, was that there was a tendency from President Hollande and other French officials to seem to be channeling George Bush, both at the moment of those horrific attacks when this horrible crime was greeted in Paris with the words, "This is war, and we will answer it with war." That was exactly the words of George Bush. It was George Bush who told us that there is only one choice, that the choice is either go to war or let them get away with it. And since nobody obviously wanted to, quote, let them get away with it, an awful lot of people chose war. The problem, of course, putting aside any sense of morality and even international law issues, just if we look at the question of the efficacy, what we see is that we've been using war for 14 years as a way of challenging terrorism. And it hasn't worked. It absolutely has not worked. If it had worked, we wouldn't have seen this escalation of terrorist attacks that we're seeing right this minute. There's this sense that there's no option. The only debate that we're hearing about in Washington right now, in official circles and the official media, is whether or not there should be U.S. ground troops. Nobody is challenging the fundamental question of, does war work against terrorism? Because the bottom line is, terrorism survives war. Terrorism thrives in war. ISIS wants U.S. troops on the ground. The notion that the only debate is, do we send U.S. troops on the ground or do we send Saudi troops on the ground? You know, that's just off. No one is challenging the airstrikes. No one is challenging the assassination program that's known as the drone strikes. You know, no one is acknowledging that this has been going on for years and it has not worked. Terrorism has thrived throughout. So what's needed is a very different understanding of what the options are, starting, I would assert, with what every medical student is taught in their first day of medical school, the Hippocratic Oath: first, do no harm. Whatever else you do to your patient, don't make it worse. And of course, what the U.S. is doing is making everything worse.
Phyllis, ISIS has often been described as a death cult, using mass slaughter as a strategy and a tactic to rebuild what they say is a long-gone glorious Islamic caliphate that they're now trying to rebuild. There are many who view ISIS as an existential threat to Western civilization if it isn't destroyed. And the military option, as many see it, is the only way to destroy ISIS, to achieve that goal. What's your response to that?
You know, if your position is the only choice is war or nothing, war seems better than nothing. War seems better than letting them get away with it. But it's not enough to say, these guys are so violent that of course we have to use military force against them. The answer is, these guys are so violent, we need to figure out much more strategically, how do we cut off their funding? Well, where's their funding coming from? It's coming a lot from Saudi Arabia. what kind of pressure can we put on the Saudis? Well, we're selling them billions of dollars worth of weapons. Let's put a price on that and say, not one more weapon, not one more smart bomb, not one more anything, until you cut all access of Saudi money, whether it's coming from the government, from the king, from some prince, from some wealthy individual. That's one possibility. We could cut off the ability of ISIS to sell the oil that they have taken. That's about half their income. Right now, the oil companies are buying and selling Syrian oil, ISIS oil, as if it was normal. There's no campaign against it, equivalent to the Blood Diamonds campaign, for instance, of a few years ago. All of these possibilities are crucial, but none of them are really possible as long as we are focused on this kind of war response.
Well, Phyllis, just a final question for you here, and that is, after the Paris attacks, we've seen some very ugly responses in the United States, particularly reactions from Republican candidates for president, to not only reject Syrian refugees, both by these candidates, but also more than 25 U.S. governors to basically block the entry of Syrian refugees into their states. But we've also had specific proposals from presidential candidate Donald Trump to close mosques, register all Muslims in the country, issue religious-based ID cards to these Muslims. What are your concerns about this? Is this something that's a temporary loss of sanity, or is this some longer-term problem that we all have to address as Americans?
I think it's both. What we have to face, we don't have a refugee crisis. We have a racism crisis underway, and we need to take that very, very seriously.
That was Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Her newest book is titled Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, a Primer. For more analysis and commentary on the response to the ISIS attacks in Paris, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After the tragic terrorist attacks that killed scores of Parisians across the City of Light, there have been calls by some U.S. politicians, government officials, and conservative pundits to reverse reforms that have recently been enacted to rein in America's mass surveillance programs initiated under the post-9/11 USA Patriot Act. CIA Director John Brennan, FBI Director James Comey, and New York City Police Commissioner Bill Bratton have been critical of the reforms initiated after former NSA contractor-turned-whistleblower Edward Snowden revealed to the world the extent of warrantless surveillance targeting millions of Americans. Republican Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas has introduced legislation that would delay implementation of restrictions on bulk collection of phone metadata that were included in the USA Freedom Act that was passed with overwhelming bipartisan support last June. Under that legislation, the government's authority to collect telephone metadata will end this year on November 29th. Another area of controversy that's come into focus after the Paris attacks is the easy access consumers now have to encryption programs from companies including Apple and Google. Law enforcement officials want these companies to build a backdoor to their programs that would allow intelligence agencies to decode encrypted messages. But critics contend that such a backdoor would make those devices and software more vulnerable to hacking by criminals and spies. Your reporter spoke with Nate Cardozo, staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who criticizes officials now calling for expanded surveillance in the aftermath of the Paris attacks as cynical politics at their absolute worst.
The calls that we've seen from CIA Director Brennan, from NYPD Commissioner Bratton, and even from the likes of Hillary Clinton and John McCain in the wake of the Paris attacks are, you know, cynical politics at their absolute worst. The Paris attacks were planned using Facebook and unsecured SMS messaging, using unsecured phones. They literally had nothing to do with encryption. At least one, and we think more of the attackers were known to European intelligence services. So to see CIA Director Brennan come out in the wake of the Paris attacks and claim that this is proof that Snowden had something, is to blame for this, or that encryption is somehow to blame, is cynical and frankly disgusting use of opportunism here.
I wondered if we'd talk a little bit about the USA Freedom Act. As I understand it, restrictions under the USA Freedom Act, passed by Congress and signed into law by President Obama last spring, will end government collection of bulk phone metadata on November 29th. In response to the Paris attacks, Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas has put forward a bill that would delay implementation of the USA Freedom Act. And he's titled this legislation the Liberty Through Strength Act. Respond to Tom Cotton and his allies that are trying to delay implementation of the USA Freedom Act, which was passed by Congress in a bipartisan way overwhelmingly.
And was supported by the Director of National Intelligence. The NSA has said that they don't need the bulk telephone metadata collection program anymore. In the entire operation of the program from late 2001 to today, according to the NSA's own testimony to both the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, that program stopped a single terror activity within the United States. And it wasn't an attack. It was a San Diego cab driver transferring $8,500 to al-Shabaab in Somalia. So all of our constitutional rights have been invaded since late 2001, early 2002. And for what gain? We stopped $8,500 making it to al-Shabaab. Luckily, Mr. Cotton, Representative Cotton's proposal to push back the implementation of USA Freedom until after the next election. Our intelligence on the Hill says that that's not going anywhere. The NSA itself has no interest in delaying the implementation of USA Freedom. They're ready to roll out at the end of this month, and it's our firm belief that that is going to happen. But just to talk about USA Freedom, the restrictions that are placed on the NSA by USA Freedom are quite minimal. But at the same time, they are the first restrictions on NSA power that Congress has passed since I've been alive, since 1978, when the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was passed. So yeah, USA Freedom doesn't do that much, but it does something to restrict the NSA's unconstitutional powers. And getting something done to rein in the NSA was in and of itself an achievement.
Well, Nate, I wanted to get to something you touched on earlier, and that is there a problem with the lack of authority to obtain necessary surveillance information, or is the problem the inability to sort through the mountains, the literal mountains of information that's already been collected in order to predict and stop future terrorist attacks?
Well, former NSA Director Michael Hayden, I think, put it very well. From an intelligence agency perspective, they don't really care much about what people are saying. They care about when they're saying it, where they're saying it, and who they're saying it to. And encryption doesn't mask any of those things. It only masks the what. It doesn't mask the who, it doesn't mask the where, and it doesn't mask the when. And what Hayden said, which I find troubling for a different reason, but for these purposes, I think it's illuminating, is we kill people based on metadata. The drone strikes that the U.S. government operates in Yemen, in Pakistan, in Sudan, are in large part, possibly in the majority, although only the CIA knows this, but are at least in large part based solely on the metadata that's being collected overseas. The actual content of the communications are almost irrelevant. So from the CIA's perspective and from the NSA's perspective, metadata is plenty, and that's all still available.
That was Nate Cardozo, staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. For more perspectives on the post-Paris attack debate on the expansion or reform of U.S. surveillance programs, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A coalition of activist groups rallied at the Capitol building in Hartford, Connecticut on November 21st calling for 100% renewable energy for 100% of the people. Organizers, including the Connecticut chapter of the Sierra Club, 350CT.org, and more than two dozen faith-based, local governmental, anti-nuclear, and other groups, oppose Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy's plan to vastly increase the use of fracked natural gas in the state, which he claims is a bridge to a clean energy future. While natural gas burns more cleanly than other fossil fuels, studies show that leaks of methane, the main component of gas, from pipes and other infrastructure, can make it more damaging to the climate than coal. Speakers at the rally addressed the health impacts of fossil fuels and called for the closure of the state's last remaining coal plant in Bridgeport. They also addressed the disproportionate negative effects on people of color, as well as labor concerns. Connecticut currently depends on nuclear power from the Millstone Reactor Complex in Waterford for almost half its electricity. Critics say the goal of transitioning to 100% renewable energy, powered by the sun, wind, and small hydroelectric, without natural gas, cannot be accomplished by 2030 or even 2050, as some advocates claim. But climate activists say, with political will, it is possible, citing examples of several U.S. cities and nations, such as Germany, that have made significant strides toward transitioning to renewable energy. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was at the rally and recorded the speakers. We hear first from Desmond Batts, a member of the Sierra Club of Connecticut's Executive Committee, followed by Bernardo McLaughlin of the group Capitalism versus the Climate.
Environmental justice means that no community should be overburdened with environmental burdens and not receive the environmental benefits. But those of us who live in environmental communities, we see firsthand that we are on the front lines. We are the canaries in the coal mines, and we are disproportionately affected by climate change. When people in Hartford look out their front doors, they don't see beautiful scenery and parks. They don't see happy families playing. They don't see self-actualized, self-aware people planning their future. But I tell you what they do see. They see garbage. They see abandoned buildings. They see cold, hard streets, colder politics, and colder policies. They don't see open spaces. They see cracks in sidewalks where green grass fights in vain to be noticed. They see empty dope bags. They see crack vials instead of smiles and dreams being fulfilled. They see violence, unemployment, suffering, and chaos. So why would they step out of their homes to take a walk or to play a game when that walk or that game could very well end in harm for them? You know, there's a big misconception about the black community that we don't care about the environment. We don't care about climate change. And that couldn't be further from the truth. The truth is that we do care about climate change, but we care about feeding our kids. We care about having a place to live. We care about clothes on our backs before that. And maybe a few more concerns, and then comes climate change. But I tell you what, when we look at the communities of color, climate change is a very small fish. But when the effects of climate change come back around, that big fish becomes a ravenous beast. It is a shark that will devour not only our neighborhoods, but yours as well. I tell you right now, today is not a time for talk. Today is a time for change. It is a time for action. I'll leave you with one of my favorite quotes by Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. He says, "A threat to justice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." Let's stay in the fight.
My name is Bernardo McLaughlin. I'm a member of a group here in Connecticut called Capitalism versus the Climate. On Monday, I locked myself to a piece of equipment in eastern Connecticut at a work site of Spectra Energy, which is expanding their gas pipeline in order to transfer more fracking extracted gas through our backyards. I did it because I'm as inspired by the strategy that led to the victory against the Keystone XL pipeline, one of the first major victories we've had recently against climate chaos. And that strategy has to be adopted and repeated. Earlier this year, Connecticut had one of its first significant real days of direct action in recent memory here in my city, Hartford, where those of us who were part of the Hartford 17 shut down one of the main traffic arteries that's used by corporate commuters to flee our city before the sun goes down. And we did it to send a message that if the wealthy and the powerful don't think that Black Lives Matter, then we'll assert that business as usual doesn't matter. And what we accomplished that day that the elite of Hartford were put on notice that our neighbors will not be brutalized without consequences. And we show that Connecticut is not immune to the radical, powerful spirit that's sweeping the globe today. We can take direct action and make our power felt if we so choose. And I'll take it a step further and argue that we don't have a choice, that the political establishment has already made that choice for us when it demonstrated to us that flooded neighborhoods in New York and New Orleans were acceptable losses as long as their penthouses stayed above water. That choice was made for us as Obama signed off on the southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline and as he presided over a large-scale federal campaign of undermining climate justice through the state repression of our fellow activists across the country. It is clear that where the line has been drawn, and we have not been the ones to draw it. I really hate going to jail, and I hate being on the receiving end of the police state that black and brown communities endure every day on a much greater scale. But most of all, I hate feeling powerless while the world goes to hell. And what I learned on Monday was that you have as much power as you're willing to exercise. When we're told to work inside the system, to cultivate good relationships with politicians who are bought and sold by the fossil fuels industry, to be respectable and law-abiding, we're being convinced that we're powerless. And what I can tell you for sure, not only as a student of history, but also as a labor movement activist and a steward with my union, is that when we're organized and been brought to the point we've been pushed to, people like us are the most powerful force on the planet. I also want you to consider what it means for us to take care of each other while we're fighting. This next week, we're going to be dealing with the consequences of another climate catastrophe that has in part to do with the Syrian civil war and its consequences there. And we're going to be back here at the Capitol at 10 a.m. next week to demonstrate our solidarity against xenophobia and hatred against Syrian refugees. Thank you.
That was Bernardo McLaughlin of the group Capitalism Versus the Climate, preceded by Desmond Batts, a member of the Sierra Club of Connecticut's Executive Committee, speaking at the 100% Renewable Energy for 100% of the People rally in Hartford, Connecticut on November 21st. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Find more information on the group's organizing against expansion of fracked natural gas infrastructure in Connecticut and across New England by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.